Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, shortly we'll get to talking about the exciting news story of the month, Proxima b, a planet around the very nearest star. But first, a few other stories from around the solar system. Join me, Edward Gomez from Las Cumbres Observatory. Welcome back, Edward.
Hi.
So you've been in the States for a few weeks.
I have, yes. Yeah. I've been running a camp for primary school kids and researching in near-Earth objects.
And so over the month of August, we had the Perseid meteor shower. Did you get out observing the Perseids at all?
I didn't, because California is so much further south than Cardiff. It meant that it was so much later in the evening when Perseus rose, yeah. And it just didn't work out.
Yeah, I tried to get out, but it was cloudy.
It wasn't cloudy in California, but I was too lazy.
Apparently there were a good show from other people reports in the UK. There were a good show of meteors, so the reports of there maybe being an enhanced shower this year from the structure of the debris chain of the comet maybe may have turned out to be true. I'm sure there'll be more analysis on that over coming months. In terms of elsewhere in the solar system, we had the discovery of a tiny object out near the orbit of Neptune, so way out on the edge of our planetary solar system. Neptune being the furthest planet from the sun, of course. And this object is unusual.
Yeah, so it's a class of object called a transneptunian object, which means that they sort of buzz between Neptune and Pluto's orbits, and they're very cold, icy things, and the same of this one. It was found by Pan-STARRS 1, so it's a big survey telescope.
So it tries to map the whole sky as rapidly as possible.
Yeah, that's right, and it'll be totally obsolete when LSST comes online. But anyway, it's finding really interesting stuff all the time, and it found this, and it's been dubbed Niku, which is Chinese for rebellious. Ooh. And the reason it's rebellious is because it's going the wrong way around the solar system. So everything in the solar system goes in the same direction, and this is nicely in line with what we think about how the solar system formed. So you can imagine the primordial solar system and the primordial sun is like a big ball of dough. And if you're making a pizza, and if any of the listeners have made a pizza, you'll know that you take your round ball of dough and you add angular momentum, you whiz it around and your dough flattens out. It gets longer and larger but flatter. And all of the dough goes in the same direction. Now imagine one small blob of dough goes in the wrong direction. That would be quite confusing. Mm. So that's how you get planets going in the same direction. But this one, we think it had some interaction, maybe with the mysterious planet 9, or maybe with some just gravitational alignment of the outer planets, or maybe it even collided with something. It'd have to be a pretty serious collision for it to change direction. But it's still going in the plane of the solar system as well. It hasn't been knocked out at an angle that's particularly large.
So we do see other objects that are orbiting at weird angles, but as you say, they're going up out of the solar system. Their orbit's been tipped up by 90 degrees.
Or yeah, that's right. This is quite common in, I say quite common. It does happen with these small bodies. So the occasional asteroid and transneptunian object and Kuiper Belt object and that sort of thing does that.
Mm. So this one really is an oddity, and we don't really have an idea of how it got that way. You said there were a few theories, but...
Yeah, that's right. Nobody really knows. And it's quite big. It's very hard because it's very far away to tell exactly how big it is. It's about 100, maybe possibly 300 kilometres in diameter.
Okay, so fairly sizable, not one of the biggest ones. So
no, that's right. And it's very, very far away from the Earth as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, an odd object that we'll learn more about over coming years. These things move very slowly, so it'll take a long time to establish exactly what its orbit's like and where it's come from, I suppose. Moving much, much, much further in the solar system, we get to a tiny spacecraft orbiting the Sun, one of a pair of spacecraft, Stereo B. There were Stereo A and Stereo B, two spacecraft observing the Sun. And we have a good news story because Stereo B has come back to life.
Yeah, that's good.
It went to sleep. They were testing some reboot procedures, essentially trying to turn it off and on again back in 2014 as the spacecraft which were orbiting the Sun were going to go behind the Sun from the point of view of the Earth. So they wanted to be able to turn them off and then turn them back on again. Stereo A turned off and turned back on again. Stereo B turned off and didn't turn on properly. It was spinning around, so solar panels weren't charging. Well, what's something called the Deep Space Network, which is an array of radio telescopes, has got back in touch with it, and maybe now they can actually get it stabilized again and get it doing some science operations. So a lot of perseverance there.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, a very scary situation that you invest hundreds of millions in a satellite that's doing really good stuff. You know, it's and it's actually the Stereo twins are studying, you know, a lot about the sun, but they're particularly useful for like an early warning system for coronal mass ejections, big amounts of charged particles that can head towards the Earth, and studying their the effect of coronal mass ejections on the inner planets like Mercury. And so to only have one of those working is just a huge shame. So it would be fantastic if it can now be brought back to full-scale operations.
Yeah. And they're old satellites as well. These are, I think it was 2003. Yeah. My name may be failing me, but I think it's about them.
Yeah, I seem to remember it was like that.
Yeah, yeah. So 13 years old. That's pretty old for a spacecraft.
Yeah, I mean, not as old as Voyager's, but... No.
And SOHO's the other one observing the sun, of course. That was 1995, so that's 20-odd years old. So we have a fleet of aging spacecraft observing the sun, so we should get some more up there.
The good thing about those is that they're not getting any further away from us, like a lot of the ones that get sent on voyages to the outer solar system. They go far away and then you lose them. These are still going around the sun. We can't visit them, but we can still get messages from them.
So fingers crossed that Stereo B is recovered in due course. Coming back down to Earth, one last story. Testing of a rocket to take people to Mars, potentially.
Yeah, that's right. So there's we tend to think about the things that launch people up into space as being about the same size as the space shuttle, and the space shuttle large booster and the side boosters as well. That's about a third of the size of the rocket that was needed to take the astronauts to the moon. Now, imagine how much bigger and how much more powerful a rocket that needed to take people to Mars would be. Mm. Well, that's the goal of the SLS, the
Space Launch System,
Space Launch System, yeah, that NASA is currently testing. And it's only testing the engine part, the part that the rockets. But they've had a successful test, which is, you know, one of the very first stages of constructing this epic mission to send people to Mars.
Well, it's an important development, and the SLS is a few years away from being ready to actually launch anything, let alone people. But it's an important step on the way, and I'm sure it was an impressive sight for those who were close enough, hopefully not too close, to see. Well, that's enough from the rest of the solar system. The exciting news this week has been the announcement of the discovery of a planet around the very closest star other than the sun, of course, a star called Proxima Centauri, or Proxima for short. Now, this result there were rumours about it a few weeks ago, and the actual paper announcing the result came out within the last couple of days. So I've only had a couple of days to review it. Elsie, were involved in the discovery. Have you had longer to get to grips with it, or are you also fairly new to it?
No, I've known about it for quite a while, actually. And actually, this is an interesting project because a lot of the research was done in the public domain. It was a project called the Pale Red Dot. And that's supposed to sound like the pale blue dot, which is, you know, looking back at the
Carl Sagan's
looking back on the Earth from a great distance, looks like a pale blue dot. So exoplanet researchers thought, well, if we could find a pale red dot, which is looking at Proxima Centauri, to see if it has any habitable life, any habitable planets around it that could sustain life. And Las Cumbres Observatory has been very deeply involved in this effort. We have a lot of exoplanet researchers using our network, but the thing that we're involved with this was making sure that any signals we got from Proxima Centauri were to do with a planet and not to do with other things, because Proxima Centauri has solar flares, stellar flares, solar flares referring to the sun. And we didn't want those to be mistaken for any planet. So we've been monitoring Proxima Centauri to make sure that, you know, we had the best quality observations for this. And And the detection of an exoplanet was done by the European Southern Observatory using the HARPS instrument.
And this doesn't just these instruments. We should say how this detection was made. They don't just stare at the star and measure its brightness. They don't use this transit method with a planet winking, a planet being blocking out a little bit of light from the star and it appearing to wink at us a bit. These are looking. It's a more subtle method of analysing the star. They're looking at the spectrum of the star. So looking at the spectral fingerprint. If you split the star's light into its rainbow of colours, you get a spectrum of dark lines in that rainbow. And there's a very tiny movement because the planet is causing the star to wobble.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And actually, you can see this wobbling in pictures as well. Not of this star, but in other star and planet systems where the planet's very far away from the star and it's very massive. You can actually see the star moving a little bit. Now, when you can't resolve the star itself and you can't see it moving, you have to resort to this other technique using splitting the light out into its component parts, and then analysing that to find this wobble.
And it's a pretty small wobble as well. So the reason it wobbles is that the planet goes around the star because of the star's gravitational pull, but equally, as well as the star pulling on the planet pulls on the star, and they actually orbit around their own centre of the common centre of mass. So the star does this little wobble in the same period that the planet does. The Earth makes the sun wobble. Jupiter makes the sun wobble.
Yeah,
example.
That's right. I mean, there's everything in the solar system goes around a point, even the sun. Mm. Now, mostly that point is inside the sun, but sometimes it can be very close to the surface of the sun, depending on how the planets line up.
In the case of Proxima Centauri and Proxima Centauri B, Proxima B, the wobble is the star appears to move towards us at about, I think it's about 5 kilometres an hour, brisk walking pace.
Yeah.
And then move away from us a few days later at about 5 kilometres an hour. These are tiny, tiny measurements. These are tiny, tiny movements of a star. And you mentioned that one of the difficulties is this thing has stellar flares, and that's what interferes with these measurements.
Yeah, that's right, because anything that can disrupt that little wobble that when you analyse the light, that can really, you know, mask the features or give you what we call a false positive. It can look like a planet in the star's light.
Now, the planet that's been found goes around Proxima Centauri once every 11 and a bit days.
Yeah.
So that's pretty close to the star.
Yeah.
It's about 20 times closer to the star than the Earth is to the sun.
Yeah, it's closer than Mercury is than the sun.
That might sound like it gets really, really hot, but there's something different about Proxima as well.
Yeah, so Proxima is cooler, which means that the planet is still within the habitable zone, this strange region about all stars where water can exist as a liquid on the surface of a rocky planet. And Proxima Centauri B is in this I was going to say Goldilocks zone, which is often called, but it's actually the little bear zone because it's little bear's porridge was just right. or baby bear. So that's the significant thing about this, is that we have a planet that's actually very similar to Earth going around our nearest companion star to the sun.
Now, the measurement technique that has been used here tells you a minimum mass of the planet. We know it's at least 1.3 or 1 and a bit times the mass of the Earth. It could be several times the mass of the Earth. We actually don't know. It depends on what the inclination, the alignment of the orbit relative to our point of view. So as you say, it could be quite like the Earth, could be much bigger, who knows. There's also a lot we don't know about the planet itself. You said that in this habitable zone, this Goldilocks zone or little bear zone, there might be, or there could potentially be liquid water, but that depends very much what the planet is doing, whether it's spinning in the same way the Earth does, because that can vary. In our solar system, we see different types of spinning as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's a huge amount that we don't know about all of this, because we've only had one measurement at the moment. We only know the mass of the planet. We don't know anything about its size and other characteristics, and we're a long way from knowing anything about its atmosphere as well. So we've got a good amount of time now that we can study it too. We know that there's something there, so it's always the initial discovery that's the hardest part.
It's going to be intriguing to see what's developed. I mean, there'll be lots of theories about what the planet is like. Is it what we call tidally locked to the star? Does it have one side constantly facing the star?
Mm.
Is it like Mercury, where it's in something called a 3-to-2 resonance? So Mercury spins on its axis 3 times for every 2 times it goes around the sun. That would change the surface conditions greatly. I mean, if you imagine being on a star where a planet where one side faced the star and the other side didn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Always night and always day, and you end up with a scorched side and a barren side. And
yeah. I know there are theories that you could still get nice weather currents from transfer of heat and so on around the planet. It'd be a very different place. But close enough that we could maybe get more information about the planet with other telescopes. It's something that I'm sure they will be pointing things like the James Webb Space Telescope and some of the next missions to analyse planets. The first ones that go up in a 10 years' time maybe will almost certainly point at Proxima Centauri now, I'd have thought.
Yeah, that's right. And particularly, there was this idea by a variety of different people. Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and Mark Zuckerberg were very keen on sending a fleet of spacecraft that were very, very small. They were basically like little bits of tinfoil that had radio transmitters on them towards Proxima Centauri and accelerate them with a mega laser.
Yeah.
So it only took 20 years to get there. And you know, that might now be the impetus to do that. I can't remember what it's called.
It was called Project Starshot.
Starshot, I think.
I think we talked about it on this program a few months ago, and that was inspired by the idea that it might be a planet around Alpha Centauri, which is links to Proxima Centauri. It's a star more like the Sun, but there could have been a planet going around Alpha Centauri, or one of the stars in Alpha Centauri system, but that planet went away again. In the data that seemed to imply it was there was not very convincing, and more data showed that it was an error, or not an error, but it was false data. It was a false positive, if you like. How the planet around Proxima Centauri is more certain than that, right?
That's right, yeah. And I think the one around Alpha Centauri wasn't detected with the same method, it's a lot easier to see with the transit method to see dips, which are, you know, that when you've got a lot of noise, they can mask a lot of things. And I think a lot of people learned some lessons from that episode.
Yeah. With this episode, there's been something interesting with the leaks, essentially, that have happened a few weeks ago with the stories in the press that basically we're carrying the headline that a planet had been discovered with no actual numbers, as far as I recall, no details. But do you get a feel for how the research team reacted to those leaks that were very much in the public domain?
I think they were the same sort of leaks that we had around the time of the gravitational waves, that they weren't specific enough that a lot of people thought, well, it's a shame that we've had a leak, but you know, it'll be much better when we've, you know, it's a teaser rather than a leak. So yeah, it's sort of prepared the public in a way that they're now already curious about this.
Yeah, and some people try and justify them by saying, well, it got all the journalists reading up and checking their notes for about exoplanets, so they're better prepared. I know the Pale Red Dot team on their blog a few days ago put up a post with a flowchart of how the process of science publication works, and basically saying that we're nearly there with this publication, so we can't say anything until there's a procedure for verifying all these results.
Yeah, and I think it's going to go into Nature,
which is a very prestigious journal.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And but it's going to be quite a short paper, and the reason for publishing in Nature is that it's supposed to be the most prestigious of publications, which is arguable, but
yeah.
There's a huge amount of publicity that's going to happen because of that.
And I know there's more analysis out about the potential habitability of this planet and whether it could have water on its surface or habitable areas on its surface, depending on what the different conditions of its rotation and so on are. I haven't had time to digest them yet. In fact, as we record this, they're not available yet. So
yep.
I wait to see those, and maybe in a few months we'll be able to talk about those in detail. But very exciting that we really do have a potentially habitable planet right on our astronomical doorstep.
Yep.
Which is very good news indeed. So on that note, Edward, thanks very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.